And so let's read chapter 9, text 13. Yadatu sarva bhuteshu darushvagnim ivastitam pratichakshitamam loko jayatayeva kashmalam. Yada, when, to, but, sarva, all, bhuteshu, in the living entities, darushu, in wood, agnim, fire, eva, like, stitam, situated, Pratichakshita, you shall see, mam, me, lokaha, and the universe, jayat, can give up, tahi, then at once, eva, certainly, kashmalam, illusion. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. You will see me in all living entities, as well as all over the universe, just as fire is situated in wood. Only in that state of transcendental vision will you be able to be free from all kinds of illusion. Please repeat. You will see me in all living entities, as well as all over the universe. Just as fire is situated in wood. Only in that state of transcendental vision will you be able to be free from all kinds of illusion. Purport. Brahma prayed that he might not forget his eternal relationship with the Lord during the course of his material activities. In answer to that prayer, the Lord said that he should not think of existing without a relationship with his omnipotency. The example is given of the fire in wood. Fire kindled in wood is always the same, although the wood may be of different types. Similarly, the bodies within the material creation may be specifically different according to shape and quality, but the spirit souls within them are not different from one another. The quality of fire, warmth, is the same everywhere, and the spiritual spark, or part and parcel of the Supreme Spirit, is the same in every living being. Thus the potency of the Lord is distributed all over His creation. This transcendental knowledge alone can save one from the contamination of material illusion. Since the Lord's potency is distributed everywhere, a pure soul or devotee of the Lord can see everything in relationship with the Lord, and therefore he has no affection for the outer coverings. That pure spiritual conception makes him immune to all contamination of material association. The pure devotee never forgets the touch of the Lord in all circumstances. You will see me in all living entities as well as all over the universe, just as fire is situated in wood. Only in that state of transcendental vision will you be able to be free from all kinds of illusion. So actually, I was told it was verse 31 that I was going to be speaking on today. So I revised that verse and I didn't even look at this one. Anyway, what to say. The point is that in the previous purport, Prabhupada specifically said that when Krishna said that you'll see me everywhere and all over the universe and in everything, in Prabhupada's purport he says that that Krishna specifically arranged for Lord Brahma to see him in his Vrindavan pastimes. So in one sense, saying that you'll see me everywhere all over the universe can be interpreted by the Mayavadis that yes, God is everywhere, everything is God, and therefore everything is one. That's why Prabhupada specifically hones in that purport on a particular pastime of Krishna, to make sure that the reader understands that when Krishna says that he's in everything and that he's all over the universe, that doesn't mean that he's lost his personal identity, and it doesn't mean that Lord Brahma then starts to think like a Mayavadi, that everything is one. He sees Krishna in everything, and he sees everything in Krishna. And in that pastime where that Brahma Vimohana Leela, then when Lord Brahma realizes that he's been defeated by Krishna, and he's looking at the two sets of cowherd boys, and he gets confused, who's who? He's not really sure whether the set of cowherd boys in the cave is the ones that he actually captured, or whether the set of cowherd boys that he's seeing playing with Krishna are the ones that he originally captured and now got out of the cave, or the ones that are with Krishna somehow or another go into the cave when he looks over and checks to see if they're still there. In other words, he became totally bewildered and confused. And then whilst he was looking, then all the forms of the cowherd boys and calves turn into Lord Vishnu. Individually, each and every one of them becomes Lord Vishnu. And not just expansions or somehow or another the potency of Lord Vishnu, but directly Lord Vishnu, because every form had the Kastuba gem and the Maka Sri Vatsa on his chest. And only Lord Vishnu, none of his four-armed associates, have those markings. So he saw each and every form turn into Lord Vishnu, hundreds and thousands of them. And then, not only that, but he saw everything that he had to deal with in the material universe was personified and bowing down and offering their obeisances to those forms of Lord Vishnu. So he saw all the 24 elements of the universe, you know, the different senses, knowledge acquiring senses, working senses, the five material elements, the mind, the ego, and so many other elements, 24 in all, that comprise this material universe. And that's the ingredients that he's working with, apart from the spirit souls, of course. But that's the how he's engineering this universe with all those materials. And not only that, but he saw the personified samskaras, the personified religious activities, the personified Vedas, the personified everything. The whole activity became personified, and he saw them all bowing down and offering their obeisances to all of these Vishnu forms that were manifest before his eyes. And he was astounded. And he was so bewildered, in fact, that he actually came to a point where he couldn't actually look at them anymore. He became blinded by the effulgence of those forms of Lord Vishnu, and he actually lost his eyesight. And then at that point, then Krishna relieved him of his bewilderment and then transformed back again. Or he exercised his yoga maya, gave Brahma his sight back again, and then Brahma was able to understand the situation, at least to some extent, and then begin offering his prayers. So when it says here that you'll see me in all living entities as well as all over the universe, he meant that quite literally. Not in some kind, you know, nebulous Mayavadi, you know, idea of everything just being one and there not being any particular shape or form because it's all pervasive. No, he actually saw all the universe bowing down to the forms, not one form, but multiple forms of Lord Vishnu, and he understood that all of those forms are manifest from the body of this little boy that's wandering around in the jungle, you know, in Vrindavan, with a bit of yogurt and fruit in his hand, dribbling through his fingers, you know, with his flute tucked in his belt. And, you know, apparently just playing like a little child. So that, this verse then, of these verses, Krishna is not just speaking, you know, in a general fashion. Lord Brahma has prayed to Krishna that I may never forget you. that in the course of doing all my activities I have to come in contact with all these material elements. And I know that's a dangerous position. You know, in the previous verses he says that I appear as the creative energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's, you know, an amazing situation to be in, to be the channel for the entire creative energy of the Supreme Lord. So it can, you know, spin your head. You know, we get a little bit of a position somehow or another. Prabhupada says even a beggar is proud of his penny. We get a little bit of opulence, something. You know, somebody has some good looks, or somebody has, you know, a little bit of wealth, or they have some prized possession, a motor car, or, and immediately they become very proud of it. You know, this is me. Just see how, you know, nicely situated I am. See what a wonderful personality I am. I have all of these wonderful opulences at my disposal. So what to speak about Lord Brahma? I mean, how bewildered is he going to become? He's got the entire universe at his disposal. He's creating planets. He's creating the bodies of all other living beings. So he's aware of the fact that this is really dangerous. And so he wants some assurance. He prays to Krishna for some assurance that I'm not going to get carried away and be lost in this material world like all of these other living beings that I'm having to deal with. I don't want to share in their illusion. I'm providing all the facilities, you know, for their daydreams. But I don't want to become part of it. When I left Prabhupada's personal service here in Mayapur in 1977, I went in, I was just about to leave Mayapur and jump in a taxi and go off back to, actually I was going to Vrindavan and then to Australia. So the last thing that Prabhupada told me was, you know, he told me, now you go out and preach. And he said, now be careful. He said, don't forget, this whole material world is a madhouse. He said, all of the people in it are all crazy. So he said, go there and try to do some good to them. He said, he's just like a doctor. He has to deal with so many crazy patients. So in the course of giving some medicine, sometimes even the patients are so crazy, they hit the doctor. But the doctor doesn't mind, he keeps on going and giving the medicine. So he said, just remember, all of these people, they're all crazy. He said, now, but don't you yourself become crazy too. So that was a warning, that you're going out, it's a dangerous position to be dealing with the material energy in any shape or form. It's very easy to become bewildered. So the only respite that we have is to remember Krishna at every moment, how Krishna is in everything and how everything is a manifestation of Krishna's potencies. And if we always see that connection with Krishna and we see other living beings as part and parcels of Krishna, then we won't fall into this illusion. As soon as we stop seeing the connection with Krishna, then we see everything is separated. Yeah? When you see everything in connection with Krishna, it all becomes connected. And you see the purpose of everything, you see how everything is interacting with each other, and it all has a part to play, it all has a significance in relationship to the whole, and to the relationship to the original cause. But you remove that cause, everything becomes fragmented. Everything becomes an individual part of its own. And you become bewildered looking at it. Just like the material scientists, they look at the universe, but because their vision of the universe, there's no core. There's no original cause. There's no, you know, point of origin. So everything that they look at is separated from everything else. And they're always trying to figure out how it's all connected. That's that idea of, you know, the pursuit of the unified field theory. That somehow or another there's got to be something that connects everything. Instinctively they know that and they're looking for that. But as long as they're in denial of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the soul of the universe, then they'll never see the connections between all the different component parts. They're in denial of that. So as long as you're not even open to the possibility of it, then how will you understand anything? So they go on, you know, lifetime after lifetime, simply speculating and being bewildered. The whole material universe is designed to simply bewilder everybody. But a devotee, because he sees right from the very beginning, he's trained to understand, Shastra Chakshu, from the scriptures, he can understand immediately from the Vedas the connections of everything. So his vision of the universe is entirely different. I was just speaking with Subhakshana Prabhu the other day about this. It's just like the description of the planets and, you know, the fifth cantile. It seems bewildering to an ordinary person. They can't understand what the descriptions are. They don't seem to fit with what they perceive. Yeah, they rely on their own senses, and they look out in the universe, or part of the universe, and, you know, they see certain things. They see some planets, they see some stars, they see some, you know, manifestations of material energy, and then they try to figure out this, you know, what they are, how they're moving, is there any connection between the two, etc., etc. So they have a perception of the universe. But in the Shastra, it appears to contradict that, what we normally perceive. The descriptions of the universe are, you know, a lot different from what we see when we look through our telescopes. You know, there's descriptions of Lord Brahma, all the demigods, that there's life on every planet, that there's different influences that affect the lives of every living being that are coming from the other planets. These are the influences of the demigods. You know, that the body of every living being is under a superior jurisdiction, that there's such a thing as karma, you know, that every living being is moving from one body to another, from one planet to another. This is the vision that's given to us in the Shastra. This is the world view of the Veda. It's all based on a spiritual principle, and then everything else is centered around that. But the ordinary material scientists, so when they read about these descriptions, well, we don't see these things. We don't see any demigods. You know, we don't see, you know, like even the description of Bhumandala, which is, you know, like the central area of the universe, if you like, for all the living beings that are entangled in work. If you go to the heavenly planets, then there's, you know, you're not creating any karma there, you're just enjoying the results of your previous activities. When you run out of that, you come back down to Bhuloka, and you have to work again. You get entangled in activity, you get entangled in karmic reactions. So this area is described very elaborately in the Srimad Bhagavatam. But what we see is a lot different from that through our ordinary senses. We only see a little globe, planet Earth, you know, a little speck. And we don't see anything else. We don't see, you know, the oceans of milk and the ocean of oil and the ocean of ghee and, you know, all the mountains that are described, the rings of mountains and all the different living beings that are situated in the different tracts of land in Bhuloka. Where are they? So the tendency is to think that this is all just some kind of an imagination, and that the description in the Bhagavatam or in the Vedas don't fit with what we perceive. And then depending on what we put our faith in, we accept one version or and reject the other. But actually, in the Vedas, there are supplementary literatures, the Siddhantic literatures, Surya Siddhanta, Siddhanta Shiromani, and others, that give descriptions of the universe which are very similar in some respects to what modern scientists perceive, you know, with their different types of equipment and through their senses. They're actually very similar. Some of the distances that are mentioned in the Surya Siddhanta match up quite well with what modern scientists tell us about, you know, how far different planets are from each other and from the Earth. So then, how do we fit that together? Because the Siddhantic literature is also a part of the Veda. It's a secondary part, but it is a part. So the answer is that you can perceive the universe in different ways. And even though you have different perceptions, they're not necessarily contradictory to each other or false. There is parts of the universe that you can perceive through your senses, anima. You know, by logic, you can understand what it is. And pratyaksha, by your sense perception, you can actually perceive parts of the universe. But then, there's other parts of the universe which are imperceivable. And the only way that they can be understood is by hearing, by receiving the information from a superior source. It's just like when we go to school, we understand a certain amount of information that the teacher tells us. But there's so much more that we don't know. It's still there. It's not that because, you know, we haven't yet come to it, that it doesn't exist. We may be doing elementary math in school, but that doesn't, mean that quantum mathematics or, calculus or whatever it is doesn't exist. It does exist. When you come to a mature point, then you can appreciate, that level of knowledge. Then the whole world becomes a different place. It transforms. You stop seeing it in the way that you saw it previously. So in an elementary way, because we have our senses, and what we perceive with our senses is true to a certain degree. To a certain degree. Just like animals. They have senses. The same senses that we have. They have, taste and hearing and sight and smell and touch. These are the same senses they're imbued with. But what they perceive through those senses is a lot different from what we perceive as human beings, or through our so-called human senses. Same senses are there, same material world is there, but the perception of it is entirely different due to the state of one's consciousness. So in the same way then, the Bhagavatam, it presents a vision of the universe, but that vision is the vision of the demigods. That vision is the vision of the sages, those who have purified consciousness, who have highly developed senses. So they see things which we don't. For them it's perfectly normal. For us it seems fantastical. When Srila Prabhupada was flying over the Alps, he told me this in 1977, he said when he flew over the Alps, he said, I saw a mountain. He said that went so high you couldn't see the top of it. Now if you fly over the Alps, you see the mountains below. You can fly over the Himalayas. Yeah, sometimes before, everything got so smoggy and polluted. But I remember flying from Delhi to Calcutta with Tamal Krishna Maharaj one time. We could see in the distance the Himalayas, the mountain range. Nowadays you can't because it's so polluted, but the atmosphere is all murky. But anyway, the point is that Prabhupada saw this mountain, and it was so high that you couldn't see the limit. So, at the time I was thinking, well, I wonder what that mountain is. I mean, in the Himalayas it's supposed to have the highest mountain range, Mount Everest, 28,000 feet. Aircraft fly at 32,000 feet, jumbo jets, so that's higher than Mount Everest. How from an aeroplane you're going to see something which is so high that you can't see the limit of it? But then I realized that, Prabhupada had transcendental senses, and so sometimes he was seeing things that we don't perceive. Yeah. And to him it's real, it's there, it's actually the universe. But it's just the state of consciousness that he's in, that he's able to perceive that by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Otherwise, Prabhupada gave the other example. Tamal Krishna Maharaj was also, because we were having a lot of discussions in 76 and 77 about the structure of the universe, because Prabhupada had told us he was really starting to push for building the Vedic Planetarium here in Mayapur. And in 77 actually he even had the devotees going out looking for people that might be able to help us to draw a diagram, according to the fifth canto, of what the universe is actually like, the structure of it. They brought some guy up from South India, they even paid his airfare and everything, and then when he You know, he said he could do it, but then when Prabhupada sat him down, the first thing Prabhupada said, so now draw it. You say you understand the fifth canto, draw it. And he couldn't do it. You know, Prabhupada was disgusted and sent him back. Anyway, he was having a lot of discussions about, you know, the structure of the universe, the fifth canto, and all these different things. And everybody was, you know, speculating in various ways. Nobody could really come up with any kind of real, you know, firm understanding. And at one point, Prabhupada told Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he said, you are prejudiced. Because he was saying, I can't, you know, we can't understand this. Is this just allegorical? Or he said, you are prejudiced. And he gave him the example of a bull, which is tied to a stake. So the bull can walk around in a circle, that's all. Because he's pinned down to a certain position. So he's got that jurisdiction that he can walk around in. And that's what he perceives. He doesn't see what's beyond that, because he can't go there. The Prabhupada told Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he said, you are prejudiced. He said, you're like that bull. You only have your attention is only focused on one point. Yeah, you've been educated in a certain way to see things in a certain way, and that's all you can perceive. But there's so much more beyond that. So we have to give up our prejudices. If we want to actually perceive the universe as it really is, then it requires, you know, giving up certain things that we become attached to, certain, you know, methods of perception that we become attached to. And we have to become willing to receive other information. The Lord Brahma, you know, he's there dealing with the entire universe because he has that, I mean, he obviously he has a vast vision. But even he's a little bit afraid, you know, that maybe somehow or another I'll become bewildered by all this stuff that I'm having to deal with, and I'll be overwhelmed and I'll forget what the actual universe is for and what the real structure of it is. So his prayer is that you please, you know, keep me free from that. And therefore Krishna arranges some pastimes, yeah, so that Lord Brahma will not forget what the universe is actually all about. So that Brahma Vimohana Leela, because it had many other uses. When Krishna expanded himself as the cowherd boys and the calves, that wasn't just for Lord Brahma's benefit. That was also for the benefit of all the gopis in Vrindavan and the gopas, because they had their own sons and daughters, and even the cows also. So they had their relationships with their own sons, but they also had the relationship with Krishna, and they always felt that their relationship with Krishna was even more than with their own children. But when Krishna expanded himself into the form of the cowherd boys, and the cowherd boys went home, those forms went home, then the gopis felt that their attraction for their own sons was now equal to the attraction that they had for Krishna. And because their sons were now Krishna, actually. And immediately they had so much more affection for their sons than they normally did. Because now they weren't making any further distinction. Their main attraction was for Krishna always. And so when Krishna became their sons, then their affection for him increased more and more and more. Unlimitedly, practically. And they were feeding Krishna, actually. When the cowherd boys came home, their parents were so ecstatic that the mothers immediately sat the boys on their laps and they began to feed them their breast milk. And normally they didn't get the chance to feed Krishna their breast milk. Only Mother Jashoda was doing that. But by this leela, then Krishna gave all the gopis the chance to directly feed him with their breast milk, and to decorate him, and they would massage him and bathe him, and, you know, put tilak on and say all the prayers for his protection, just like Mother Jashoda was doing. So for a whole year he allowed them to do that directly to him, because they didn't realize it was Krishna, but they felt now that their affection for their own boys was equal to their affection to Krishna. like that. So that, you know, that was another transcendental purpose that Krishna had in arranging that pastime. Same with the calves and cows. When the cows saw their calves out pasturing, they were up on Govardhan Hill. So immediately they went mad. And it's explained that they already had, by that time, new calves. They had some younger calves. And those young calves were the ones that were taking the milk from their udders. Now the older calves that Krishna was out herding with the cowherd boys, they were no longer allowed actually to take the milk from the udders of their mothers. They were out pasturing. They were eating grass on Govardhan or on the fields around Govardhan. But when Krishna expanded himself as the calves, then the affection that the cows felt for those calves increased unlimitedly, even more than they had for the young calves. And so they abandoned the young calves and they ran down the hill like mad. They were leaping and bounding, not caring for, you know, the rough paths and rocks and everything. They were just bounding down and rushing towards these other calves. And then they immediately began licking them like anything, and they were feeding them their milk. And it was at that point that Balaram started to twig on what was going on. Because Balaram, when the cowherd boys were originally stolen and put into the cave, then Balaram actually, although he's normally out there, he wasn't there because it was his birthday. So Mother Rohini had kept him home and she was doing various pujas and special bathing ceremonies. So he had to stay home that day, and so he wasn't there when Lord Brahma came and stole all the calves and cows away. And similarly, exactly a year later, when Lord Brahma came back and looked to see what was going on, Lord Balaram again wasn't there. He was back home because it was his next birthday. But in the meantime, during the year, between the two birthdays, he was going out and he was totally unaware what had gone on. He actually thought everything was just the same as it always was, until about 5 or 6 days before his next birthday. Then he saw this incident of the cows rushing down and then, you know, immediately wanting to feed their older calves and neglecting the younger calves. And he was thinking, how can this be? There's something, you know, strange going on here. And similarly, he saw that the cowherd men who were herding the cows, they immediately became angry because all the cows just immediately ran off and wouldn't obey them. So they ran after them to get them back. But when they ran down and then they saw their own sons with the calves, then they also, they gave up their anger and immediately they began to smother their boys with affection. They were smelling their heads and they were hugging them, and it was with very great difficulty that they were able to actually break themselves away from their boys and then go back with the cows to their business of, you know, pasturing them on Govardhan Hill. It took a lot of effort to drag themselves away, and they were crying that they were having to leave their sons and go off and, you know, do this work of taking the cows and herding them around Govardhan Hill. So Balaram was watching all of this and he was thinking, this is really strange. Krishna must have done something here. Yeah. Otherwise, how can all of this have happened? He knew only Krishna could have made such kinds of arrangements. So Krishna was standing at the side and he was grinning because he could see now Balaram's twigged on what's really going on. So then he filled him in and he told him everything that had happened. And then Balaram was, you know, quite happy. So anyway, the point was that when Lord Brahma came back, because there are many purposes served in all of these pastimes, so the main purpose in this pastime was to fulfill these prayers of Lord Brahma that he made at the beginning of his work of creation, that I may not become bewildered, that I may always see you in everything and see the whole universe in you and you in the whole universe. He wanted to retain that vision. So that's not some nebulous, you know, indescript idea. It's very, very specific. And this is the pastime that Krishna arranged so that he could remind Lord Brahma who he really is and keep him from forgetfulness. He specifically manifests himself into all these Vishnu forms and bewildered him, but with his Yogamaya potency. So in that way then, anyway, that's one example, because the other example that Prabhupada gives there is when Lord Brahma went to Dwarka and he asked to see Krishna. And then, you know, the message came, well, which Brahma are you? Tell Krishna Brahma has come to see him. And then the message came back, which one are you? And then he was amazed that, what do you mean, which one am I? You mean there's more than one? Well, yeah. And then Krishna, alright, the four-headed one, let him come in. And then just to remind him of how small he really is, and then he brought all the other Brahmas. He gave him a vision of all the other universes. So whatever's going on in this one vast universe, you know, that Lord Brahma has to deal with, it's insignificant compared to what's going on, you know, when you look at the expansion of all of Krishna's energy. There are millions of universes, there are millions of Brahmas. You know, some of them have 10 heads and 100 heads and 1,000,000 heads. And when our Brahma saw that, he was, you know, quite impressed. That put him in his place. Yeah. So these pastimes then, these are direct responses to the prayers of the devotee. So whatever a devotee prays for, he gets. Yeah. As long as it's not something nonsense. Prabhupada says that sometimes Krishna doesn't fulfill the desires of a devotee if he prays for the wrong things. But if he prays for the right things, he always gets it. And one example of that, it's interesting actually, because the last chapter of the Bhagavatam that Srila Prabhupada himself personally wrote was the 13th chapter of the 10th canto, which is the Brahma Vimohana Leela. And that's, you'll see the last purports that Prabhupada wrote are all in that chapter. So in one of those, Prabhupada talks about this desire of the devotee. And he says that one time, a devotee desired that in a secluded or uninhabited place of Vrindavan, that there be deities and seva to be performed. And so the Supreme Lord is very kind, and he has fulfilled that desire of a devotee. Now it's become a thriving place. He's talking about himself, and he's talking about the establishment of the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And then Prabhupada says, such is the desire of a devotee, and such is the relationship that a devotee has with Krishna, that whatever a devotee desires, Krishna will fulfill. So Lord Brahma had this desire to stay out of Maya, and Krishna fulfilled that by engaging him directly in his pastimes and personally appearing before him, showing him all these Vishnu forms, or appearing to him in multiple Vishnu forms, and then showing him all the universal ingredients that he's dealing with, all bowing down and offering their praise and worship of these Vishnu forms. So in that way then he understood then what is my real position. So the pure devotee never forgets the touch of the Lord in all circumstances. That is Krishna's blessing. Yeah. The devotee is never in forgetfulness of Krishna at every moment. He always perceives him. Whatever he's doing, whatever is happening around him, he sees Krishna in everything. That is the perfection of our lives. Okay, we'll finish at that point. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Vasudev Prabhu. He's also all-pervading. Vasudev. Vasudev is our
Samiti. About all of us getting his disciples to search about the structure of the universe in order to design a planetarium and in order to be able to have a visual impact of that universe that seems to be so elusive. One may wonder, just like Prabhupada used to very precisely direct his artists how to paint Krishna paintings, and obviously because he knew the have the information from the Veda than to Kutsi directly. So why is it that Srila Prabhupada would not also direct his disciples how to understand the structure of the universe? And instead he would send them to science and learn to do all kinds of research, and they came back with nothing.
Yes, the answer is, two answers are possible there, or maybe more, but there's two I can think of anyway. One of them is that when Shukadev Goswami is giving his description of the universe, that's the fifth canto, right, he's describing all the planets and inhabitants and whatever, he also gets to a point, he says, beyond this I can't say. Yeah. He gives some, like a synopsis, if you like, of the description of the universe. But the universe is so complex and so vast, it's not actually possible to describe it. Even Lord Brahma can't do that. So Shukadev Goswami, he also in his discussion, in his description to Maharaj Pariksit, he makes that comment that he said, beyond this, I cannot say. But you just have to be satisfied with what, you know, the bits that I give you. So in the same way, Prabhupada told us, he said, I'm only a layman. He said, I've translated all of this, but actually understanding all of this is very difficult. So we're not going to be able to present everything. That's not possible. But the idea is that we should present enough of the Vedic view of the universe to convince people that Krishna exists, every living being is a spirit soul, not this body, and that there is a spiritual purpose, you know, to the activities of the living beings in this material world. That's the purpose of it. So we can present somehow or another a view of the universe based on the fifth canto, which is credible. It doesn't have to explain everything, but it should at least be credible to the point where people think, yes, the information that is in the Bhagavatam, this is actual real knowledge. This is not mythology, this is not imagination, you know, this is real. And then that will, as Prabhupada said, there's information in the Bhagavatam which can provoke further scientific research. He wants people to look into it more and more. So that, in that sense then, Prabhupada is leaving us with, you know, our future preaching activities. That's the other part of it, is that in giving us this job of building this, you know, Vedic planetarium, that will enhance our own spiritual lives by entering more deeply into our understandings. And it will also enhance our preaching. Prabhupada wants to capture all the scientists. Yeah? He wants to change the materialistic worldview to a spiritualistic worldview. And this Vedic planetarium is the means that he was going to, one of the main means that he was going to use for that. So he knew that he wasn't going to be here long enough himself to do that. So he was eager to get us, you know, started on it at least, you know, to give us the initial shove that don't think this is not, that this is unimportant. Prabhupada put a lot of emphasis on, you know, starting this work for building this Vedic planetarium in 1977. He was fully aware of the fact that he wasn't going to be around himself much longer, but he put in a lot of time and energy to try to get us, you know, seriously pursuing it. And the idea is that then after his own disappearance, that then we wouldn't just think, oh well, this is just too difficult. Yeah. He wanted us to take it seriously, and therefore, you know, in 1977 he had that foundation stone laid at Gopunima for the temple of the Vedic Planetarium. It was the last foundation stone that was laid in ISKCON. Yeah. Sometimes people say Bhubaneswar was, but it's not. The last one was actually, you know, the foundation stone for the temple of the Vedic Planetarium. So that's significant. So it's a job that's been left to us, that's all. Every acharya does a certain amount, and they leave a certain amount for all the next generations of Vaishnavas.
say what has been done since 1977 by way of furthering our realization of that design, because there is also the risk of, instead of interesting design, this is to make fool of ourselves if we don't have ourselves a clear enough picture of what we are going to do.
Yeah. Well, in 1977 we only had a few scientists, and they themselves also were not fully mature in their own Christian consciousness. So unfortunately, you know, for a few years at least, there was a lot of struggles and not much product, you know, from their efforts. And it was a little disappointing to see that they weren't even able to work cooperatively together in the way that Prabhupada had instructed. You know, they tended to break up and go off and do their own things. But there was some progress made in different fields. You know, Bhaktisrupa Damodar Maharaj had his own particular fields he wanted to pursue. Sariputta Prabhu was pursuing his own particular interests. And other devotees also were doing that. What's different now is that we currently have a team. Well, there's a kind of like a hardcore team of about a dozen devotees, you know, that have been working on this for many years, that are now meeting, discussing, and, you know, cooperating very nicely together to start, you know, the construction of this temple. And we have a Vedic cosmology team with about 20 devotees that are doing, you know, different types of research involved in that. We have a plan this year and next year is research. They're going through all the Vedic literature, all the Puranas, all the Siddhantic literatures, everything they can get their hands on that says anything about Vedic cosmology. They've set up what they call a Wikipedia, yeah, which is, it's just an information sharing network. You put all your material on the wiki and then you sort through it all, and people, different people commenting on it, and out of that you hope to come out with something, you know, sensible that everybody can agree on. So we've got a 2-year program for doing the research. The third year will be dedicated to coming up with a concept of the chandelier. So the chandelier, Prabhupada said, in the main dome of the temple, he wants a gigantic chandelier, 200 feet across, he said. And it will depict the positions of the main planets and their movements. So somehow or another we have to figure that one out. So that's the third year. Once they've done the research, they'll start working on, you know, the conceptual model of that chandelier. And then the fourth year, they have to start actually building the model. They'll do the computer modeling. And then after that, then we actually have to construct the thing and put it into the temple. So anyway, that's, at least right now, we see that there's some very strong impetus, you know, to actually manifest this now after, you know, 30 years, Prabhupada. More than 30 years, Prabhupada was talking about this. But we're actually at a point now where it looks like we can really do something significant. And apart from that, of course, there'll be an actual planetarium in one wing of the temple. And there are many other devotees now that we have. Now we have actually quite a few devotees that have got, you know, let's say material qualifications, you know, degrees in various areas of science, and they can all make, you know, some contribution. Now we've got like Drudakama Prabhu, he's another aspect of material science he's attacking, you know, from the evolutionary idea and providing evidences, you know, to demolish that idea. So we want to go in from many different angles, and the idea is that we'll get to a point where we present something that's so credible that material scientists will not be able to ignore it. Yeah, they'll have to look at it seriously, and that means they'll have to start looking at the Bhagavatam seriously. Just like a few years ago, one physicist, I think is Henry Stapp, He's a physicist? Yes. So Rasaraj Prabhu, because he's also doing his work in quantum theory, etc. So he brought this physicist, quite a well-known physicist, Henry Stapp. I met him when he was there in Bombay. He was researching on the Bhagavatam. He was trying to understand some aspects of his own work through the Bhagavatam, because Rasaraj had actually convinced him that this is credible knowledge, that there's something here, you know, which will enhance your understanding of the universe if you just look at it. So that's what we want. That's Prabhupada's idea, was, you know, to build something which would challenge the materialistic worldview, and it would be credible enough that people would actually start looking at the Vedas, they'd start, you know, taking these descriptions seriously and start trying to understand the universe, you know, from an expanded spiritual point of view. So it's a big work, it will go on, but this will be like a beacon, if you like, and then from a beacon then light goes out everywhere. That's the idea. Prabhupada said, I want that there will be scholars coming from all over the world here to Mayapur, yeah, just to study the Bhagavatam. That's their intent. So, you know, whatever we do, I mean, there is a place that the Jains built some years back. I forget the name of it now, but they built some, they took the Puranas and they attempted to actually build a model of the Puranic universe. And then when they built it, and I read, there was a one-page article that was in Time or Newsweek, one of those, I think it was Time actually. Anyway, they visited the place, and the article starts off, you know, quite interested, oh, what have they got here, they're presenting, you know, an ancient text vision of the universe. But actually, as the article progresses, you know, they interview the guy that's in charge of the display, and he can't explain anything. He has no idea, you know, what Mount Meru is, you know, whether it's real or false, or, you know, and what to speak about anything else. So the end of the article is that it just made a complete laughing stock, you know, of the whole attempt. It was just ridiculed. So we don't want that. We want something which will be taken really seriously. Yeah. Just like even nowadays, I mean, people, if you tell them evolution is not a fact, they all think you're crackers. Yeah, don't they? If you tell them that you know, you don't believe in evolution, they think you're some kind of fanatic or, you know, crackpot. Everybody believes in evolution. It's all pervasive practically. But Drudhakama Prabhu, when he speaks, they take him seriously, because he's done it in such a way that they have to take him seriously. He's presented, you know, evidences and logic and reasoning. So that's what we want. They may laugh at us to begin with, but Prabhupada said that's the beginning stage. First of all, they abuse you, then they laugh at you, and then they start to listen. There's different stages that they go through. All right? Okay, we better finish then. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.